Hey, good evening and welcome to another one of our webinars for the American Herbalist Guild. Our presenter for tonight is Sevensong, and I've been on some herb walks and been to some Sevensong classes, and I think he's a great teacher, and you're all in for a wonderful treat tonight. So Sevensong, take it away and tell us about first aid for the practicing herbalist.
Unmuted.
Hello, everybody. This is Sevensong. Many of you have just seen me right. Now you could hear my blend of Long Island, Brooklyn accent. All right. So first, this is my first webinar, and I don't think I have it timed quite as good. So this is what I'm going to do. I have a lot of slides here, about 50 of them, and I'm going to go through them as quick as possible after I do this introduction. But not go too fast. In other words, if I don't get to one of these segments, you could just download it and look at it later, rather than just try to run through everything fast. Next is being a little bit odd, talking to myself at that picture you see in front of me there. I want to say that all the photos that you're going to be seeing are photos that most of them. The exception, of course, is this photo that you're looking at, which somebody else took, since I cannot take pictures of myself while taping somebody's leg. That would be extraordinary, and having an extra long arm would be very helpful in first aid. This class is going to be based on my clinical experience doing first aid. I started doing first aid. I mean, herbal first aid is just first aid, right? And then the difference is a few of the medicines we use and a few of the medicines we use less. So as you can see in this picture in front of you, I'm taping up somebody's leg. I have some reasonable understanding of how to put tape on a leg and how to hold the gauze in place. So a lot of this stuff, for all of you nurses and doctors and first aid workers and people who just work on your kids or yourself and your family, some of this will not be that interesting because, as you can see on that black clean sheet, the sterile sheet behind you, the only herb there is propolis. So I'm going to keep moving. So once again, tonight is about herbal first aid. It's really about first aid using herbs. And here I go. So these are some of the things that I would like to cover tonight. How to prepare a first aid kit and some of the common first aid situations I see. They include injuries, infections, and allergic reactions. By allergic reactions, I mean allergies. But there's a couple different kinds of allergies. So basically, I mean what I call type 1 histamine-induced allergies, or immediate on hay fever, hives, when you eat food and you have a quick reaction to it and your tongue swells, those kinds of reactions. We're going to also talk about preparing a first aid kit. This is my bag, and I'll come back to that in a bit. We're going to talk about some common medicinal plants. The one in the background is one of my favorite plants in just about every way, and that's yarrow, or Achillea millifolium. In New York State, by the way, downstate where I'm from originally, I'm now in Ithaca, New York, Achillea sounds a lot like Achillea. So it's not exactly what it does, but I just like saying it that way. And a warning, there'll be some gruesome pictures. This one is not that gruesome. That's a hatchet wound. Actually, that hatchet wound in front of you is who I'm wrapping up in the very first picture you saw. Saw is the New York for saw. But I think we did a good job. I only worked with him one day, so I'm not actually sure what happened afterwards. But this kind of thing with a pretty clean tool, we can talk about. We'll talk about. One of the places I've gotten a lot of my experience is from rainbow gatherings. And there's a lot I can say about rainbow gatherings. Frankly, a lot of it is negative. There's a lot I don't care for about them. But I've been going for 30 years to the rainbow gatherings. And for the past 20 and more, I've been working first aid. And so the Rainbow Gathering, I'm not going to go into a description. It's a whole class in itself. It's a free event that you can go to. If you want to find more information, you go to welcomehome.org, welcomehome, one word, .org. But the thing about it is that there's 10,000 people gathered in the woods. sometimes more, sometimes less, but around 10,000. And I've been working at the primary first aid station there for more than 20 years, which has given me a lot of experience, because when you're in the woods, even though it's a big gathering, it's not that quick that you can get somebody to an ambulance. You have to hike them out, put them on a stretcher, helicopter them, which is very expensive, and often helicopters can't land. So I want to say that a lot of my experience, when you hear me talk about it, is a bias towards these very large gatherings, the rainbow gatherings, where people are around for a long time. So when they get hurt, if they get really bad diarrhea from eating something, get a really nasty cut, something goes in their eye, we're going to be primary and then decide if we have to bring them to a hospital, and they'll decide too, but we'll be making decisions. So the upper left-hand picture is us building the first aid station. By us, I mean other people. It's not my skill to be building. To the right of that is this year's first aid station, and you can just see it's a big tarp and we're underneath it. Below it, there's Lorna. If you're out there, Lorna, hello. And that's where the herbs are. And then to the left is just a bunch of hippies like myself. I just happen to be a swearing hippie, so I'm a little bit different that way. But there's about, 2,000 people in that circle there on the 4th of July. When you prepare your first aid bag, put these things in now, tonight, or soon. Every first aid bag, you don't put the herbs in first. You put the herbs in, maybe not last, but in the middle. So put disposable gloves in so you don't pass infection around. Make sure you have a small headlamp, different kinds of bandages. You can use plants for bandages, but bandages work so much better. So if you don't have them, you have to improv. And improv is the name of the game. But to bring bandages with you, I'll cover this a little bit more. Tape, nothing sticks like tape. There's a bunch of different kinds of tape. And then something to cover your face up. I like the bandana look, kind of the outlaw thing. But you can also just have a respiratory mask. Here's some pictures. So on the upper left, it's me working on somebody's finger with gloves on. On the right is a couple of different kinds of lamps, lights. Below that is the first aid. A wound care kit, things like steri strips and band-aids and tape. On the left is a bandana and respiratory masks. When you're preparing, I can't get feedback doing this, and my tendency is to go a little bit fast, so excuse me for that, but I'll continue this. All right. So when you're preparing a bag, think, what size first aid bag do you need? If you're just going camping, it's going to be a really small thing. I don't even have a small camping bag. The smallest thing I have is on the left there. We'll talk about it. That's my wound box. Kind of a medium size. That's the bag on my back in the middle. That's me in Florida doing some first aid, actually just watching the night. And then on the right, there's the first aid at the Rainbow Gathering with Annie. And you can see there that we need lots more stuff because there's lots more people. So considerations are, what size first aid bag do you need to make? Is it for your home? Is it for your car? Is it for when you're backpacking? And these are things to take into consideration, because you can take a lot of stuff in your car. This is the first aid bag I use. I'm actually working with some people to make a new one, but you can get a sense of it. It's kind of heavy. It weighs about 22 pounds. I use plastic bottles because they don't break, and they're much lighter. And the most innovative thing I think I thought of, I think you can see the arrow, is in the first aid bag, there's a strip of plastic so that I can see what the plants are. They're in alphabetical order, but things get messy because you move through stuff fast in first aid. So being able to see what's in there has been really helpful. And then on the all the way to the right, you can see that there's pockets for other stuff. So this is the first aid bag that I've been using. It's about 10 years old and really starting to show it. So I'm working on a new one with Simple Folks. This is my wound box unpacked. So this is when somebody has a wound and I'm working someplace like the Rainbow Gathering or any place, even in my school, and the student steps on something or cuts their hand, they're using pruners badly, then this is the first aid bag box that I take out. I call it the silver wound box. And this is what's in it. So in a couple of weeks, this presentation will be available for free online. And I want to thank Stephen. I want to thank Brian Bowen for inviting me, and Mimi for helping me out, and Stephen, who's doing the technical stuff tonight. So, and the American Herbalist Guild for offering this for free. It's really appreciated. So thank you to everybody there. So you can see on here what's there, and you can always come back to this. So this is what's in my wound kit. I'm not going to go over individual stuff. We'll do that later. When you are preparing your first aid bag, think, what are you likely to encounter? Now, pain is pretty much everywhere. Pain is basically the crux of first aid, right? Pretty much everything has pain. Get poked in the eye, step on a nail, get bit by a dog, sprain your ankle, have diarrhea. So pain medicines are really helpful to know. I'll cover a few of them later. I am going to talk about plants and herbal medicine. But think, if you're going someplace, are you more likely to see lots of allergies or digestive upsets or chronic respiratory infections because you're in a place where they exist? And so now you're preparing the size of your kit. Now think, what do you need to pack in it? What are you most likely to see? Like, I used to work at some music events around Ithaca, and sprains were the most common because people would be dancing, get tired or not get tired, and their foot would go in a hole and they just twist it. So lots of sprains and strains there. So what people really wanted were magic potions to stay awake all night long. And I suggested caffeine as their magic potion, which we don't carry. Next, first aid considerations. Before you go to do first aid, what do you need that may be difficult to buy? What can you improvise, or what's going to be expensive, and bring those with you? Because when you go to a drugstore and buy packets of bandages or vet wrap, they're very expensive. But if you buy them online or in bulk, they're much cheaper. So these things on here, could, you know, think about getting them. Something like an EpiPen, you need a prescription for. So EpiPen is what you do for anaphylactic shock. I'm not going to go into the specifics. I just want to discuss considerations. And so some of your considerations here are get stuff while it's cheaper, stuff it's really hard to improv. Actually, probably you can improv a hot water bottle. You probably improv an eye cup. Soap basins maybe. While crafting tools would be more difficult. Gloves would be very difficult. You'd have to just put a t-shirt on your hands. So I hope you're getting the sense of, before we talk about herbs, set yourself up. When you're working in a first aid station, and if you're doing something that's more than a few hours and it's a few days long, one of the considerations is, how can these people take the medicines away with them? So if somebody limps to you, so at the Rainbow Gathering or just some camping event, some outdoor survival event, I'm not sure, but there's a lot of people, and somebody comes to you limping because they hurt themselves, and you give them some medicine, some anti-inflammatories and pain relievers. And what they have to come back in 3 hours or 2 hours to take more, that's just going to damage their body part. So how can you give people medicines to take back? I use these very inexpensive, they're very inexpensive because somebody donates a couple of hundred every year to me, to the first aid station. But this is what we put them in. That's a 1 ounce bottle there. And so I can give people medicines and tell them to come back the next day or the following day, or they can send somebody. Also, I can put a label on there and put what's in there because people always forget what's in. I mean, they're not trained to remember what's in their medicines. So this way, they know to come back. They know what's in there. It's often good, by the way, if you're working with a couple of people in a first aid station, to put your name on it. So if they come back and you can't read it, you can just find the person. So if it says Abby, you can say, is Abby here? And then Abby can refill it or talk and check the person out again. So now we come a little more gory. These are some dog bites. This man was bitten. Actually, he was bitten by his own dog. So he had less. Often animal bites, people are really angry or really scared because it's just, we're just not used to getting bit by large mammals anymore. But he got bit by his own dog. And I'm just showing you, I'm going to talk about the herbs. This is a progression. So the second day is on your left there, and 7 days later, it's much better. His hand is fully functional now. It's somebody I still know. So I just thought I would show you some, and then we're going to cover some specifics. This one is lovely. A bunch of you out there right now are going, oh, that just looks delicious. You're thinking, can I suck that thumb? And what's that little black dot? That little black dot, by the way, is just dry blood. There's no bone protruding. So, yes, beautiful wounds. Very clean wound on the upper left. We cleaned it. Right, 2 days later, still looking good. Just showing you the bandages in number three. And then 2 years later, he came back, and thumb's looking beautiful, isn't it? But the body, a healthy body, has a lot of good regeneration. It's not just herbs, it's sanitation. It's a big part of this, and him taking care of himself. Now that's delicious. Woo! So that's like the mayonnaise and ketchup. So that's like the French dip for French fries on your left there, mayonnaise and ketchup, otherwise known as pus and blood. This person was bit by a spider, and I just want to say now that the majority of people, I mean the vast majority of people who think they have spider bites have staph infections. And so even if the spider bite caused the staph infection, which can happen, but he has a clear spider bite, and you can tell because the skin is peeling back due to the necrotic factors of the venom in whatever spider bit him. He never saw the spider. On the right of it is actually just the next day. We just kept draining it, and it's starting to look better. It got much better in a few days. Once again, you can see some of the stuff below it, and I'll cover it in a bit. All right. So supplies for cuts and wounds, disposable gloves and water. Make sure you have a good place to get rid of infected stuff. You got to keep sanitation. Even you saw that we were outdoors and all of our stuff is there, but still we're constantly washing our hands and making sure infected bandages and infected water go someplace safe. Because if you just put it on the puddle, dogs will drink it or people, kids will play in it. And then bandaging supplies down there. I'm trying to get to the herbs. So here are some of the treatment categories. So right now, I'm talking about infections. Most of these could be internal or external infections. External infections, the most common infective organism is Staphylococcus aureus, otherwise known or commonly called staph. Staph is just prevalent. Lots of people have it and never get infections. For some people, just your normal skin biota, your normal, what's, you would, when you think of gut flora, we also have skin flora. Your normal skin flora just keeps the staph at bay. Given certain circumstances, other people's staph, nobody's quite sure. All of a sudden, the staph gains hold, and you have things like boils, impetigo, and just all different kinds of external infections that the bacterium staph is there. So a lot of what we do is try to kill staph. One of the questions often is if the person has, what if they have MRSA? And the answer is, I often don't know if they have methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA, MRSA, because it doesn't matter to me because I'm not giving them methicillin drugs. I'm giving them herbal treatments. So really, really, really clear. There's definitely people I've worked with staph infections and the herbs don't work and off to get antibiotics. Sometimes it works, sometimes they don't. But I want to be excessively clear here that a lot of situations I'm in, I don't help the person, and that the herbs are doing nothing, usually not making them worse, and it's time to seek medical help. There's no FDA or hospital approval board behind me. This is just the flipping truth, right? Our goal as herbalists, our goal as people is to help people, not to give herbs. Our goal is not to give herbs. Our goal is to help people. So if somebody's getting worse, or if you don't know what you're doing, or whatever the situation is, hospitals can be very expensive. We know all the ins and outs. But if you live, that's better than having some kind of crazy staph infection that might leave lots of sores and infections on your body. So I definitely treat staph infections, and there are definitely times when it's beyond my ken, my abilities. So some of the things we'll use for infections. So in external infections are often staph. Internal infections are a huge variety, bacteria, fungi, protozoa, and viruses. It's way too much to get into here. So, but again, internally, I mean, externally you can have these, but internally, you know, virus and bacteria infections are very common, and protozoas like Giardia are also fairly common. So I'm not going to talk about that here. I'm going to stick to external infections. So the categories, I feel like Jack from Jeopardy, the categories are absorbent for 100, analgesic, anodyne, and anesthetics for 100, anti-infective, and there's the barely double. So absorbents are preparations that you put on externally that draw infective material to them. The most common absorbents, the most active adsorbent is definitely activated charcoal. I'll get to that in a minute. and then clay comes next. But activated charcoal is stronger than charcoal, which is stronger than clay as far as helping molecules, helping stuff adhere to it and holding it so you can help pull the infection from the person. It's not a cure-all, and it has to come into direct contact to work. The next qualities are analgesic, anodyne, anesthetic. These are things that reduce topical pain and internal pain. So an anesthetic is a topical agent that you put on that stops pain topically. I've never found an excellent herbal anesthetic, right? So there's no herbal lidocaine that I know. Analgesics and anodynes are often used internally, and there's lots of pain relievers, and I'll get to them, because pain, again, is a big part of treating people in first aid. Anti-infective agents are things that kill infections. In this case, externally, the most common infections I'm treating are bacterial infections. The most common bacteria is going to be staph. Anti-inflammatories, you should know your anti-inflammatories if you do first aid. Along with pain, inflammation is a very common occurrence. And inflammation causes pain because it creates a stretching motion which sends nerve signals down the local nerves so that your body knows that something is damaged. I mean, it's not a coincidence that we feel pain. It can be very annoying, but not a coincidence. So anti-inflammatories, and I'll cover a few. So all these still are for infections. The next category are anxiolytics, nervines, sedatives, and trauma aids. I'm going to cover these in a bit. Keep going. Astringents are things that help tighten tissue. I'm going to go back up. So anxiolytic, nervine, sedatives, and trauma aids are things for the nervous system. Astringents tighten tissue. Hemostats stop bleeding. And vulnerates help wounds recover, especially sprains and strains. Here's a very odd case that we saw. I'm going to come back to herbs. A gentleman came in, and on the upper left, he clearly had pus coming out. He had an infection. There's no question there. I mean, there's pus dripping out of his leg. And then, I'm laughing. It was so weird. So I was working with Kenton. Hi, Kenton, if you're out there. And Kenton's like, should I lance it? I'm like, lance it. Right? Lancing means cutting it with a very sterile, very sharp razor. So we lanced it, and all of a sudden this little piece of blue plastic comes out. So we take the plastic out, and then he keeps poking around, and then this splinter comes out all the way to the left. So that was one of the weirdest things. So clearly, the splinter, because you can see the hole is the same shape as the splinter, somehow that thing, I never figured out what material it was made from, pushed in that plastic. After we got that out, he just started feeling better because there was so much pressure through the plastic in his leg. Next, when you're working with external infections, mark off the wound area so you can watch the progress of it. So this one is getting better. When we put that black line around it, the red was all the way to that line, and you can see that the red is moving towards the middle. That, by the way, the black in that is activated charcoal. He doesn't have an infection. He got better every day. He was very good at taking care of himself. Patient compliance is huge. Activated charcoal, just throw some in your first aid kit. I don't buy the capsules. They are very expensive. You will spend $12 on what comes out to like a teaspoon. Buy it in bulk. So I don't have any money invested in this company, but I buy it in bulk from activatedcharcoal.com, activatedcharcoal.com. And I can post later what grade to buy, because you don't need a high grade for what we're doing. But activated charcoal is really helpful. We have there is me making a poultice on the upper left. That's putting it on a bandage. The middle, that person actually has a snake bite, a poisonous snake bite. I put activated charcoal on it locally, but actually it was doing very little. I mean, the venom was not spreading all the way in, but was staying local. And then on the bottom right, that's a bad staph infection. And I just want to show that the activated charcoal is not in the wound, because otherwise we'd have to wash it out. So we're putting activated charcoal in what I call an activated charcoal sandwich. I'll give everybody, myself maybe, 5 seconds to breathe before I go on. So I just want to say that when you're using a powder and somebody has a deep wound, like the bottom right side, you don't want to get powder in the wound. You just have to wash it out again. So what we do is we take the activated charcoal and we put it in the middle, we put it on top of a gauze and surround it with gauze. And you'll see it more later. But just showing you, activated charcoal absorbs a lot of junk. It absorbs a number of bacteria. It absorbs a number of bacteria toxins. And it just helps pull pus up and other stuff. And it holds it pretty tight. And internally, it's just great stuff. I can easily do a class on it. But I will say just research activated charcoal. When you're researching stuff, avoid the polarities, right? That's the classic research technique. Avoid it doesn't do anything, and avoid it cures everything, and go for some people who are in the middle ground. So these are plants for infections. They're all done a little bit differently. And what I think I'm going to do, I apologize for going so fast. This must be terrible. So.
Your pace is actually very good.
I'm going to cover each one here and kind of give an
overview. Your pace is actually very good.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. that obviously Stephen's talking to me, which is really helpful because the screen does not. So I want to cover each one of these. These are all good, and I'm going to talk about them mostly for external infections. Chaparral is probably one of the strongest anti-infective plants. So it's very safe externally. I mean, there might be some weirdness to it, but I don't know if I've ever seen it create a problem externally. So you could make strong soaks from it with it and soak the wound. So to make a soak, so chaparral you can decoct or infuse. So it just depends what's easiest. So infusion is when you pour boiling water on a plant, as in making a tea. Decoction is when you cook the plant in the water, more like making a soup. So chaparral is just, you know, it's it's strong smelling. Here's a public, this is a private service announcement. So I have a Facebook page that I keep very active, and I've recently been writing about chaparral. So on my Facebook page, as many of you know, is Seven Song, Seven Song, with SevenSong. And so I just post stuff. It's all free. You know, I mean, if you don't like Facebook, don't use it, I guess. But I'm on there, and I find it an excellent way to put a lot of free information out there. So, and I've recently been posting about chaparral. So chaparral just kills a lot of stuff. It doesn't kill everything. It sure is not, you know, some staph is easy to kill, and some staph is hard to kill. But I would say if somebody came in with staph infections on a place that I can soak hands, feet, lower legs, wrists, chaparral would be my first choice to make a strong soak. A soak is just a very strong tea that a person's putting a body part in. And then my other choice, which I actually use more because the plant is more common, is yarrow. So the top of the list is chaparral, the bottom of the list is yarrow, and those two, when I see infections and I can get that person's body part in the hot tea, not boiling it, If it hurts them to put it in, it's actually tricky. You don't want to damage them with excessively hot water. That's tricky, right? Because people's variation on the ability to withstand heat is very different. So it could feel hot but not damage them. But what I'm saying is putting it in boiling water and scalding them will create more problems because you damage local tissue. All right. So chaparral and yarrow are my favorite soaks. If somebody has an infection, make a strong tea, and I put the body part in. The plant matter can be in there. It doesn't have to be in there. But, you know, it's infected, so you have to make sure you get rid of the water and the plant material well. Conifer resins are just really handy, not for big wounds, but for small wounds. So if you're out in the woods and you're using a saw and cutting a branch of some butternut to peel the bark and use as a laxative, and you accidentally cut your hand, and now you have a saw cut on your finger, and it's bleeding badly, and it's jagged, and you don't have anything with you. See if there's any conifer trees. By conifers, I mean all the conifers, pines, junipers, spruces, firs. But the one that makes the most resin around here are pines. And you take that, see if you can find an open wound on a pine tree that has dripping resin, and then just spread the resin on there. So the resin is just like propolis, basically, which will come up later. It'll help like a Band-Aid sort of thing and protect it from the environment. Plus, it has antimicrobial properties. So conifer resins are just really helpful. Now, if you have a big, like if you've got a road rash and you were running in the woods and you slid and you took a bunch of skin off and it's bleeding, putting that much resin on is going to be sticky and hard to work with because you have to get the resin off eventually. Isopropyl or regular alcohol will take the resin off. Also, it comes off by itself as your skin sloughs off with time anyway. Just regular skin sloughing off. So conifer resin is really good. I tend to use echinacea more internally, and even though echinacea is hugely touted, I think it's just one of the best herbs to increase innate and adaptive immunity. So innate immunity is what you're always trying to stimulate in first aid situations. You want those white blood cells, those granulocytes, those neutrophils. You want those scavenging white blood cells to come into the area as soon as possible and start scavenging any potential infection. And so the echinacea I tend to use much more externally. It's historically used in the United States by Native Americans. So here's a word about me. So even though I have the name Seven Song, I'm a total Russian Jew, and our family just changed the name. It was Seven Songovitz when we came from Russia. Now it's just Seven Song. That's not true, by the way, but I'm saying I'm not Native American. Just have long hair. So echinacea when you look in the Native American literature, it's just so commonly used externally for infections that someday I'll give it more of a try. But I don't see much of it, so I just have it in tincture form. I never gather wild echinacea. It's just not that common. Garlic is mildly anti-infective, and I use garlic mostly internally, frankly, just to help those aromatic constituents. So people have infection. Frankly, I don't use garlic that much for staph-type infections. I use it more for viral internal infections like respiratory viruses. Golden seal and Oregon grapefruit, I'm skipping myrrh for a minute, both of those berberine-containing plants are just fantastic. I use more Oregon grapefruit. I use more berberis species because there's many more berberis species, and most of them, I don't know any of them that are endangered. So I'm talking about Oregon grapefruit, Japanese barberry, agarita in the southwest. The golden seals and Oregon grapefruits are just great external agents for infections, putting them on bandages and putting them locally and internally. They're not the strongest. I would say maybe chaparral and yarrow are stronger to decrease the staph from spreading, but especially Oregon grapefruit, it's common, it's easy to use, and it makes a really strong tincture. And so if Oregon grapefruit grew someplace where I was watching infections, I would probably decoct it, boil it, and soak body parts in it, which would be interesting because I think it would turn yellow. But I haven't tried that yet. So Oregon grapefruit, golden seal for infections, externally, internally. I'm going to skip myrrh. I don't use it as much. It's harder to buy. OSHA, I do occasionally use it on external infections, but OSHA I tend to use more for internal infections, especially respiratory viruses. So I'm jumping around a little bit here because with OSHA and garlic, I actually use them more for internal infections and more than I will use them for bacterial infections, but also for viral infections, respiratory viruses, gastrointestinal viruses, if the person could hold the medicine down. Propolis is what I carry when I travel. So when I travel and I have to have a very small kit, there's two things that I carry. They're activated charcoal and propolis. An activated charcoal, if I get a wound or infection internally or externally, to put it on, and propolis to just cover it up at other times. So let's say I'm in Nicaragua and I fall down and I grab a tree falling down. This is even worse. Sometimes you learn, like in Central America, when you fall, like don't grab a tree because often they're spiny and sometimes the spines get embedded. So I fall down, grab a tree, some little spines go in me, all of a sudden they're flaring up and getting red and infected. Pull out the little spines, and propolis, I'll just immediately put it on there. And so for a lot of things, for a lot of external infections, propolis is one of my favorite. And you can learn more propolis is elsewhere. On we go. Okay, another 5 seconds. Take a breath.
You're doing great.
Go to the bathroom.
You're doing great.
And come on back. So these are just pictures of the plants. As I say, I'm a photographer. And so we have, thank you, Stephen, yarrow on the left, Echinacea purpurea, which is growing wild in Missouri, to show me your echinacea state, and OSHA on the right, probably either Wyoming or Colorado, the two states I see the most. More photos. two Oregon grape roots in the upper left, Berberis aquifolium, Berberis nervosa. The middle is golden seal. Just a shout out to Paul Strauss, who's definitely not listening. He avoids computers. But Paul Strauss has been a great person to have in my life at Equinox Botanicals, teaching me a lot about how to grow some of these, or watching somebody else, because I don't grow them. Chaparral in the bottom right-hand corner. So astringent plants, you can use them internally and externally, and I'm going to talk more about externally for the moment. So astringent plants, many of them are rich in flavonoids. And so flavonoids, most plants have flavonoids. But so you hear a lot of like bioflavonoids, which is kind of a made-up word, meaning that our bodies absorb it. Our bodies absorb almost all flavonoids, not like cellulose or something. So the astringent plants are excellent wound washers to add to other things. Yarrow is a little bit astringent. Chaparral, not really at all. So sometimes when you have a wound, you want to disinfect it, but you also want astringent plants to help the mantle of the skin to reform. You want to start having those tissues closed down. And most of these astringent plants have some anti-infective qualities themselves. So again, you would use astringents, like you would use astringents particularly what's called a road rash or a skateboard burn, right? So you're running and you skid and you take a bunch of topical skin off, but it's not really a chance of infection, but you still want to get that skin to regrow sooner. So the astringent herbs will help with that by reducing the free radical content and being free radical scavengers, antioxidants, and at the same time promoting tissues forming new bonds. So astringent plants are really helpful. Tip of the hat, much more than a tip of the hat, to Michael Moore, one of my main teachers, and one of my many teachers, but a big influence on me, because Michael Moore swore, and I love to swear. And it was so good to hear a more well-known teacher at that time swear, and I was like, all right, I'm released. I can do it too. So, but I will try to, the kids might be around listening to this and looking at pictures of the disgusting wounds, so I'll avoid that for now. So I just want to cover a few of my favorite astringents. So I would say out of all of them, my favorite on this list is number 5, oak. Oak for 300, Jack. This famous species is found throughout the northern United States. So there are many kinds of oaks. Often people talk about white oak being more astringent. It is. But most oaks have good astringency. Here's the trick, though, with every one of these plants to get the astringents. All right, so very quickly, astringents are based on groups of chemicals called tannins. So the tannin is the thing, it's a group of chemicals, and the action is astringency. So tannins create astringency, and astringency is basically a drawing and tightening of cells and tissues. So astringent plants, the tannins in most plants are tightly bound in the tissue and don't come out very easily, and so you have to decoct them. So even if it's agrimony, which is a herbaceous plant, or lady's menthol leaves, if you want most of the tannins for the astringency, boil them. They're fairly stable, boiled. So you would take, let's say, geranium root, throw it in hot water and boil it for 10 minutes, and then you have it more astringent. Here's the proof. So number 8 is tea, and by tea I mean black tea and green tea. If you take black tea and pour hot water on it and drink it, it's not very astringent because the astringency is still bound in the leaves. If you take black tea and cook it, decoct it, and drink it, it will make you pucker right up, which is what happens with astringent plants, because the astringency comes out. So basically the flavor and the caffeine comes out with just some boiling water on top of them. The astringency has to be cooked longer. So I just want to say that oak is one of the more common ones, and that it's just a great astringent. So back to Michael Moore. So Michael Moore liked this term called ARFA, another rose family astringent. Most of the plants in their rose family, and there's a couple of them here, so agrimony, blackberry, cinquefoil, are all, and lady's menthol, are all in the rose family. And so, but most plants in the rose family, if you cook them, are astringent, and very few of them, I can't think of any offhand, are toxic, because that's always the deal, right? Plants, lots of plants have tannins, but you don't want having other stuff that you don't want in there. So the plants that I list here are safe plants. The most problematic one is probably tea, because if you were drinking a bunch, you would get all the caffeine, right? And so for some people, caffeine just wires them. So this is a list of astringent plants. Cook them. Soak body parts in them. Here's a couple of pictures. Yerba Monza, I love this plant. Well, Michael Moore really adored this plant, and I adored Michael Moore, and I adore this plant. Witch hazel, which I use a lot because witch hazel is a common plant in the Northeast where I live, in the United States. Very quick note on blackberry root. So when I talk about blackberry, it's the root. And blackberry root is one of the best astringents for diarrhea. It does not kill the infective organism. So I'm doing a jump here. I'm talking about an internal infection creating diarrhea. But you cook the heck out of a bunch of blackberry roots, and it's one of the, I don't know what it does to the bowels, but it tightens them. But that's problematic, right? Because if when you have diarrhea when you're sick, your goal is to get stuff out of you, right? It's supposed to get brown liquid out of you and carry stuff that you don't want in your body out of you. But then it continues too long, you become dehydrated, et cetera. The blackberry root's one of my favorites. So after you kill the infective organism, or you just have to drive someplace and you have to stop and poop every 4 minutes, blackberry root is what I would suggest. Cook the heck out of it, though, and drink it. Really strong. All right. So I said before that there's different plants that affect the nervous system. They're all related to each other, but I have them categorized here as anxiolytics, which means they help reduce anxiety, and anxiety is very common in first aid. Get bit by an animal, have a car accident, have something fall on your head, that damn piano fell again. You know, we thought that happened in movies. So anxiolytics are herbs that reduce anxiety. You know, a classic anxiolytic would be a cup of wine after a hard day's work, or whatever you drink to relax, right? So you're not sedating yourself. You're not really nourishing your nervous system. You're just taking yourself a step down. So kava is good. Could be strong for some people. And then chamomile and peppermint are nice anxiolytics, just relaxing without really affecting your mental state too much. Nervines help relax without being very sedative. Sedative means that you can't think. You can't operate heavy machinery as well. So some of my favorite nourishing nervous system remedies are tulsi, which is some people call sacred basil, passion flower, and blue vervain. These, the nervines, you can take forever. Put them in the freaking water supply. I said, just take out the, all right, I was going to say fluoride. Fluoride is a little bit tricky for you dentists out there. We can have a reasonable discussion on fluoride another time. And while we're putting that in there, let's throw some freaking tulsi in the water supply and see what happens to people. And maybe some milk thistle, too, to help detox. So, but those three plants, tulsi, which is osmium tenuiflorum, passion flower, and blue vervain, are just really relaxing for the nervous system. They're actually not the best all the time in first aid because it takes their action a little bit of time. But passion flower in particular will sometimes just lower the person's like anxiety a little bit or their uptightness. Tulsi, by the way, is better when people are scattered. That's when it works really sweetly. So somebody comes in and they fell down or they hurt themselves somehow. They hit their hand with a rock while putting a tent stake in. And they're just scattered. They just can't focus. And tulsi is really nice because it helps bring them back to focus. Calamus too, by the way, there. Sedatives decrease mental activity. They're sedating. But they're better at pain relief. So skullcap and valerian and wild lettuce, Jamaican dogwood, these things actually will sedate and reduce the pain because you care less. Now you've finished the bottle of wine. So, but you know, a lot of times it's dosage. Skullcap in small doses can be very relaxing and very nervous system tonic, large doses sedative. So often it's the amount that you take. The last group are trauma aids. And trauma aids have a special niche in medicine. And for me, they often accompany panic attacks. And once again, like I said with anxiolytics, that panic often will accompany certain people. If you go into the Ayurvedic mode, people who are more vata, people are more sensitive in general. They don't have to be vata, just more sensitive. Something happens, and they freak out. And they're just stuck in fear. They're overwhelmed. My favorite herb for that is definitely anemone, but also St. John's wort helps there at times too, which is a much more common plant. So anemone at a different time. And then these are some pictures. Kava root, passion flowers, passion, I'm freaking, we should just draw it everywhere and no one have to drink it because it is so crazy lovely. Anemone on the bottom right, one of the many anemones in many species. And then Scutellaria lateriflora, the skullcap that grows in the northeast. Actually, it also grows in the northwest. All right, another breath. I'm not sure why I'm telling you that since you can't see me. So if you don't know that I am wearing a 1940s bathrobe with my hair part on the side, I'm smoking a pipe called Rob. So anti-inflammatory plants, they all work a little differently. So I want to just cover a few of these. Most of the anti-inflammatory plants, I'm looking to see if this is true. Now, I use them internal and external. So let's start with the RO. So anti-inflammatories reduce inflammation. Inflammation happens with every first aid accident there is, right? Whether you have a toothache or bang your head or got bit by a dog or have some bacterial infection, all the lovely things. Just, all right, now you do your best Julie Andrews voice and say, these are a few of my favorite things, and then, you know, as the dog bites, as the rock hits you on the head, etc. And so it's good to know a couple of anti-inflammatory plants. I'm going to start with yarrow, the bottom of the list. So yarrow is great because it has mild anti-inflammatory action, but it's also disinfecting, so it covers two bases. Most of these other plants don't do that. So the beauty of yarrow is it's a good disinfectant and a good anti-inflammatory. So if somebody had an infection, I would give them a lot internally if I wanted to speed up the recovery and kill stuff, and externally, and also reduce inflammation. Beautiful there. Willow is incredibly common. I recently wrote about it, and you can read about it. I wrote a blog about it. My website is sevensong.com. Another private service announcement. If you're interested in going to herb schools and you like sarcasm, I would suggest maybe my herb school if you like potty mouth sarcasm with a New York accent. Is there any other kind? My school is in Ithaca, New York, and it's the Northeast School of Botanical Medicine. On my website, though, I have a lot of free information, and I've recently been talking a little bit about willow. So the beauty of willow is it's just common. It's the cambium layer, it's the inner bark, that's the most medicinal part of willow. But if you just need it as an anti-inflammatory, internally or externally, just cut the young branches and decoct them. Cook them for about 15 minutes in hot water to get those salicylates, the group of chemicals that are anti-inflammatory, out of the willow. So you can read much more about willow later, but I'm telling you, just as an all-around anti-inflammatory, sore joints, you have a sinus infection and you're all stuffy. So as an all-around anti-inflammatory, willow is by far one of my favorites. I don't know which species is strongest. I've never seen any studies. I use the one that grows here. I'll show you a picture in a minute. But I think that probably all willow species, Salix species, have different qualities. I'm going to jump to meadowsweet. Meadowsweet is my favorite gut anti-inflammatory. And chamomile works great here, too. So if the person has an infection from listening to me speak so much, so right now you're like, I can't, not more. You don't have to say anything, Stephen. So, you know, it's like, oh, no, now my stomach hurts from listening to this garbling of information, and it feels inflammatory. I would suggest a really nice cup of meadowsweet tea. Meadowsweet just tastes good. It makes a great tincture. I tincture it dry. I used to tincture it fresh, but now I tincture it dry, 1 to 4, 50%. And gut inflammation, meadowsweet. So it's not going to stop ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, but it's one of the herbs to put in your apothecary. Now, those are chronic health conditions and not infections. But I'm just saying that I'm a big fan of meadowsweet. Anytime when you think the gut is inflamed, and by gut, I mean anything from your mouth gains. And I think I'm going to keep going here. I know there's a lot of other herbs, but those are some. So yarrow, anti-infective, plus anti-inflammatory. Willow, good all-around anti-inflammatory. Meadowsweet, a gut anti-inflammatory. And then I use arnica tincture externally. I usually use arnica liniment externally. I think I'm going to avoid it here. And I use arnica tincture as well in really small doses internally. So if somebody has somebody has inflammation, whether due to sprains, strains, or infections, but not gut infections, I'm going to have to start again on this one. Arnica doesn't really fit in here well. I use Arnica tincture internally for sprains and strains, giving 2 to 3 drops as often as needed. It's more complex than I want to get into here. I just want to say that I do use Arnica, and I find its results really good. A couple of drops at a time. If the person's really small, a child, you just got to figure out what you're going to do. It's much trickier than working with an adult. So, but I always carry Arnica tincture, but mostly for sprains and strains, not so much for infections. There are some pictures, Arnica latifolia on your left. There's the willow I use, Salix X. X means it's a hybrid. Rubens, Meadowsweet on the left again, and then turmeric, which is a fantastic. One of the great ways of making turmeric is you make either a vinegar or a honey, and you just blend the plant in the vinegar or blend the plant in the honey or the alcohol. And turmeric is pretty good patient compliance because a lot of people recognize it. If they have to take it a lot, though, it gets too strong tasting. So I do like the turmeric. All right, so write down any of your questions in your copybooks about infections, and now I'm going to move to allergies, and I'm not going to get to sprains and strains. I'm going to probably finish up here. I have about 10 minutes left. So now I'm going to be talking about allergies and allergic reactions. So I hope you have a sense of what to do, though, with infections. I probably should have covered a little more carefully. So in front of you, you see hives. Hives is the name of a histaminic reaction on the skin. It's to the skin what hay fever is to the respiratory tract. It's a group of cells called mast cells releasing certain chemicals, histamines being the most common. And I'm going to keep moving. So these are, I'm only talking about type 1 hypersensitive reactions or immediate response allergies. There are classic allergic responses that come on right away and are due to the group of chemicals called histamines. There's 4 types of allergies, so I'm just talking about the ones. To work with allergies, here's some of the things you can do. So antihistamine type plants, I'll get to those in a minute. Anti-inflammatories, anti-inflammatories don't work in the early stages of most things like hay fever. They work in the latter stages of when the histaminic reaction sets off a different reaction, which includes the group of white blood cells called eosinophils, and then you have inflammation. But initially, anti-inflammatories aren't so important. The next are the same group, just make the person feel better if they have allergies, anxiolytics, etc. Astringents, not usually so necessary. Constitutional tonics, really important. So you try to figure out what type of person they are, thin and dry, medium and fiery, heavier and stagnant, or any combination. That was kind of my quick Ayurveda, Vata, Pitta, Kapha. Excuse me, I have a cat who has decided to come onto the laptop. Say hello, Pedro. Maybe you heard that. So constitutional tonics to treat the person not when they're having an allergy, but to help them become less sensitive to the allergens. Decongestants for congestion, of course. Some pathomimetics when the person. I'm going to leave off the rest. What I want to focus on. I'm sorry, I lose a little focus here. What I want to focus on is the antihistamine type plant medicines. So these are the herbs that you do if somebody has hay fever, has allergic asthma, hives, or a digestive thing that comes on quick. Now, incredibly clear, if somebody is going into anaphylactic shock, if somebody's blood pressure is dropping or their throat is closing, always carry an EpiPen. Carry some kind of adrenaline giving device, because herbs don't work there, right? You only have a few minutes or less to deal with it. So if you're going to do first aid and be serious about it, get a prescription, carry your EpiPen, or there's a few other kinds, and just have it on you. I mean, I've had some situations where herbs can help, but it's just nice to know that the person's not going to die, and people are going to survive the epipens. So there's two main herbs. I have four here, but there are two main herbs for allergic responses. They are ragweed, which is my favorite, and ivrite. So I'm going to say it again. So this one always throws people off and stinks of the doctrine of signatures, which is not something that I follow. So ragweed, especially the one in front of you there, Ambrosia artemisiifolia, definitely causes a majority of the hay fever wherever it grows. It is a native plant, by the way, to the northeast of the United States. All of the ambrosias are native plants that I know of. So it's one of those weird things that the plant creates something and helps it. So fortunately, there's not a, when I teach this in a class, 100 hands go up right now. I can't answer all the questions about them, but I'll cover a few right now. So first I want to point out in the bottom left picture, that's the staminate flowers that create the pollen that cause the hay fever from ragweed. And in the upper right-hand corner, that's that whole stem that you see rising there, that's the pollen-bearing inflorescence. That's the pollen-bearing part of the plant. So people are allergic to ragweed because it makes separate male and female flowers. It's monoecious. And then the pollen is just highly allergenic for whatever reason. But ragweed, for whatever chemical reason, and it's just one, you know, there's thousands of plants, almost none of them cure what they cause, but ragweed is one of them. So ragweed is an antihistamine plant, or antihistamine type plant. I don't know if it actually stops histamines, but it does stop histamine reactions, hay fever and hives, to just go with two of them. So you gather the plant before it goes into flower. And you can see down here, this is the leaves that I'm going to tincture down here. Here's a young plant over here in the upper left. So I use it as a tincture. If somebody's allergic to ragweed and you want to give them the tincture, the tincture rarely causes the histamine reaction. I'm going to say this again. In first aid, every day I do first aid, I see lots of people with allergies. They're very common. Lots of stuffy people, occasionally hives, digestive problems, because lots of people have allergic responses. I go through a gallon a year of something of ragweed tincture. In all the time that I've given ragweed tincture for allergies, I've only seen it make the person worse about four times. So that person you give it to could be the fifth person, but I'm saying that I consider it fairly safe. Here's how I test it. Somebody comes in, they're all stuffy, you make sure it's not just dust or a cold, in fact it's allergies, they know because they have allergies. Then I would give them one or two drops of the ragweed tincture under their tongue. Actually just in their mouth, doesn't matter if it's under their tongue. I wait about a minute, and if the ragweed tincture doesn't make it worse, then I'll give them more. So here's my experience. If small amounts don't make it worse, large amounts don't make it worse. Occasionally, I give the person a few drops and they start to breathe better because ragweed can work pretty fast. So I'm saying I always carry ragweed as an anti-allergy medicine. The only problem with it is people freak out because they have allergies to ragweed. So sometimes I don't use it because I don't want to do this whole explanation thing. Some people get around it by calling it by its genus, which is Ambrosia, and you can do that too. So something you can do is just say, I'd like to give you some Ambrosia tincture, but I don't know, I'm too Jewish or something, I feel manipulative already. And so I just say this is ragweed. I don't want to play around, I don't want to hold my thumb over the ragweed label over there. And by the way, just to make sure it's not too prejudicial, I am raised as a Russian Jew. So, and then I just feel like if I say something like that and I'm hiding the bottle, it just gets too awkward for me. So lots of people, of course, don't ask what you're giving them, but ragweed is my favorite antihistamine plant. It's common. Gather it before it goes to pollen. Go to my website or go to my Facebook page or ask somebody you know how to make this tincture. it works pretty good, maybe 30-40% of the time. But everybody tends to develop tolerance, just like the Benadryl, right, which is the over-the-counter antihistamine. You know, you give it, and you're like, wow, ragweed works, and then a couple of weeks later, even a week later, it's not working as well. Our bodies develop tolerance to things. Here's a couple of other ragweeds that grow around the United States. Three of them grow in the Southwest. You can see I wrote Southwest, Ambrosia, Deltoidea. I have never used these, by the way. So there's Corey Pine, who's an herbalist in Asheville, North Carolina, uses the Ambrosia trifida in the upper right. But I just want to point out that there's lots of ragweeds around the United States. Really, there's a lot of ragweeds in the East, and there's a bunch in the Southwest. All of them cause allergies, though the Artemisia, Ambrosia Artemisia folia, the one around here, causes the most, I think. My second favorite is eyebright. So eyebright is just harder to find, but nobody minds eyebright, right? It's such a pleasant-sounding plant, and look at that. Isn't it cute, right? It's just an adorable, sweet plant, and, you know, you can't even trip on it. So look at that bottom left-hand picture. I have my pruners in there. Those are eyebright plants, and that's about as tall as they get. So eyebright is also an antihistamine-type plant. I use the non-native eyebright. I've never actually seen the native eyebrights yet in the United States, so I use this one, Euphrasia officinalis. I find it growing with non-native grasses, and so I feel fine gathering it. I feel like it's not very common. On the other hand, it's not a native plant. I mean, I don't take all of it because I love eyebright and want it to prosper and grow. It's an annual, so I always leave some eyebright around. So I tincture the eyebright fresh. I just tinctured some dried for my first time, and I'll see if that works. It's very safe, though. You can give nobody, you know, somebody has an allergy, you can give them eyebright, and they'll just take it, and sometimes it really works. By the way, the reason it helps a lot of eye problems is its antihistamine-like action. So a lot of times when people have itchy eyes, so it's not so much like you have an infection in your eye, but if you have itchy eyes, actually this tissue around the eye is very histaminic, and that eyebright just works like a charm. I don't know, some charms are good, some charms aren't good. Lucky Charms probably shouldn't be eaten, though my cat likes the green marshmallows. Lucky Charms, which I never feed them. And so if you're listening to this, Joy, no more feeding my cat the green marshmallows and Lucky Charms. But it works well. So I had to at least not be linear for a minute there. I've been linear too long. It will drive me crazy. So with allergies and allergic reactions, I'm going to stop in a few minutes, by the way, and then go on for questions. With allergies, get the triggers. You know, try to reduce the triggers in the person, whether it's food or airborne, if they can wear masks, because allergies begets allergies. So, but often if you work with the person, sometimes you can reduce allergies. Sometimes the person has, and here's a big thanks to Paul Bergen, who's taught me a lot about the digestive system and food allergies, is that for a lot of people, they're eating things or interacting with substances that make them more sensitized towards allergens. And sometimes if you reduce it, like sometimes people who eat a lot of dairy and don't do well with dairy, many people do fine with dairy, but if they don't, the dairy's not causing a big problem, but it seems to just push them that much further, and then the pollen makes them worse. So what I'm saying is try to figure out if there's any kinds of, not just triggers for allergies, but things that are sensitizing the person and look towards their diet. Not an easy thing to do. So the last herb I'm going to cover here is for allergic asthma. So this is when your bronchi constrict. Sometimes the bronchi constrict, get inflamed, and make mucus, which makes it very, a lot of wheezing going on then. So Lobelia inflata, I don't use any other species. Lobelia inflata is an amazing plant for opening the bronchi. Lobelia inflata is one of the plants to convince people that herbal medicine works. We can forget that human beings from every culture and every part of the planet use plants, or have used plants for medicine. And so we can say, okay, we forgot all that because we've had 60 years. I mean, I love modern medicine and it saves life, but plants also work. So it's not like modern medicine is not good. It's that plants also still have a part in our apothecary. But Lobelia often works so fast and so clearly that it makes people believers. But don't give asthma to people, just so you can prove this. I'm not sure how you would give asthma to people. And so it's the tincture of Lobelia. Once again, Paul Bergner has written an article about Lobelia. If you have a lot of fears about Lobelia, It occasionally makes somebody vomit. A couple of people I've known, but very few. I give so much Lobelia, and it's definitely acrid at the back of the throat. If you put it in your mouth and it hits the back of your throat, it's acrid. It's acidy tasting, annoying to tissue. But Lobelia inflata, if you have asthma due to allergies, if you have bronchoconstriction and you're wheezing, then Lobelia is the best plant. Lobelia does a bunch of stuff. I would say Lobelia has four or five fantastic qualities, and it would be one of the first plants I would pack into any first aid, particularly because asthma is so common. So I find out more about Lobelia tincture, but I want to say here again that for bronchoconstriction, for closing of the bronchi, due to allergies, that Lobelia is just one. It doesn't stop the allergy. It's not antihistaminic. It's a bronchodilator. And when it works, it does it in seconds. So the person comes in and they're making those wheeze. Everybody makes some wheezing noises. I'll give you 2 seconds. Okay. So you hear that noise and you give a few drops of Lobelia, just like 3 or 5. You can give more. I mean, it's not dangerous. I mean, it's acrid, so it's a little dangerous that way. If they drink an ounce bottle, they're probably going to vomit. I'm saying between a couple of drops and a half drop of full, pretty safe dosage. Often people will just start to breathe better because it will deconstrict, it will open up their lungs. And it's not a sympathomimetic. It doesn't increase, it doesn't make them wired. It's not like giving an EpiPen. I don't know what it does, but it just opens the bronchi up. So Lobelia for allergic asthma. These are some other herbs to consider for allergies. There are decongestants and anti-inflammatories. And that is where I will end. So you still there, Stephen? I wonder if anybody can hear me.
I'm here.
Okay, good. I just realized I could have been talking to myself for 25 minutes.
It does take getting used to.
So do you want to ask some of the questions? Is this a good time to start, Stephen?
Yes.
Okay, I'm ready.
Let's see. Okay. First of all, for all of you people who asked if this is being recorded and will be available online, if the handouts will be available, yes, we are recording it. It will be posted on the AHG website. Yes, it will be available to the general public. And yes, there will be handouts of the slides. The first question is, somebody was asking that about the plastic bottles. Do you have any concerns with, you know, the toxicity of plastic, the leaching chemicals? Do the herbs last as long in plastic as they do in glass? Go ahead.
Unmuted.
Go ahead.
So it's a good question. And I used to use just really high-quality plastic. Here, I want to say this. The rubber is your enemy in bottles, glass or plastic. It's the rubber that degrades. I mean, how many times have you opened up? So I'm not going to just try to avoid the question about plastic. But I want to say that the rubber scares me more. If you looked at my first aid bag, you will see that it sits on its side. That means the alcohol interacts with the rubber, and I can definitely taste rubber. And every couple of months, I just have to throw out stuff because my tincture is polluted with the rubber droppers. I don't know how much of the alcohol, so it's probably like 40 or 50%, most of the tincture, some of them are more, 60% alcohol. I don't think it's a big problem to keep them in plastic for a short amount of time, but honestly, it's just a trade-off. Glass is just way too heavy and breaks. And so what I used to do, I just stopped because I got a better deal. I used plastic that is alcohol resistant, and so actually those bottles are more expensive than glass. But that would be one way to get around this. Ready, Stephen?
Okay. Have you ever used prickly ashes?
Prickly ashes.
Anesthetic.
I've tried. I haven't used it much. So I've gathered prickly ash. Prickly ash. So xanthoxylum. There's two that I've used. Xanthoxylum clavihercules and xanthoxylum americana. But xanthoxylum clavihercules, the western prickly ash, if you ever want a xylagogue, something that makes you just drool, try the bark of that plant. It's amazing. Whatever it does, it just gets salivary glands going. But I haven't found it to be a very useful anesthetic yet. And I've tried it once or twice with people with toothaches because, you know, some of them are called toothache trees. But I haven't seen it as effective as I'd like to. So the answer is I haven't given a lot of try. I've tried it a few times, and it doesn't seem to be a really helpful anesthetic, or I haven't used it properly. But a lot of times it's just me. Next.
Okay, some people have some questions about the ragweed tincture. They said you only use the leaves, right?
I only use the leaves because I have – all right. I don't think that if the pollen got into the tincture, it would do anything because the pollen has to get into your nose and interact with the mast cells in the sinuses to actually cause a reaction. I think, and a few other people, I've talked with Kiva Rose and Jim McDonald about this, that who are excellent herbalists, that none of us feel like the tincture with the pollen, but I don't make sure the pollen's not in there just to make people feel more comfortable. So the shorter answer would be, I just use the leaves.
Great. And you said that you have directions on how to make it on your website?
Yeah, I make it fresh. I forget what it's like, 1 to 3.5, and I do it at 80%. So if you don't know what that means, but I think I have it on my website or Facebook. If you go, it's not easy to search Facebook pages, unfortunately. But yeah, I basically make a straightforward tincture of the fresh leaves. I haven't tried the dry leaves yet. They probably work. Ready.
Okay, this is a little longer, so muted you to avoid the echo. There's some questions here about lobelia, about why you only use the inflata, and also how you use it as a tincture, tea, inhalant. So go ahead and answer that.
Unmuted.
So this is about lobelia inflata. It's funny because somebody asked me about cardinalis today. So the reason I only use lobelia inflata is that's the one that's in the literature. That's the one I learned, right? And other people use other species, but I've tasted about 5 species. There's a little bragging thing here going on, but I'm a botanist, and so I know the species. I mean, whenever I go out, I try to identify stuff, and I've identified a number of lobelia species, and none of them taste like lobelia inflata. Now, of course, organoleptically, your favorite Michael Moore word, doesn't always speak to its value as a medicine. So, but I just, all right, so here's the real answer to it, right? Lobelia inflata grows around here. It's the species that I found valuable. The other ones don't taste like it. I've never seen proof from anybody else that any of them work. If I did, I guess I would suggest them. And that's the real reason. I used it as a fresh plant tincture. If you make the fresh plant, this stuff is acrid. I mean, some of my most painful experiences a few years ago, I found a bunch of lobelia. I was so excited. So I gathered a bunch of lobelia, lots of it. It's an annual. And I gathered a bunch of it, and I chopped it up, and I just didn't think about it. But all whatever the juice or the stuff in it got in my face, in my throat, in my hands, in my eyes, and it just hurt. So I am saying that lobelia definitely has acrid constituents, and now when I find a bunch of it, I wear a bandana because my throat was just raspy for a long time. It actually stayed on my clothing for a while. If I didn't wash it and I put on the same clothes, it would start, all of a sudden, I'd touch myself. It would just be painful. But the real reason is I've only used lobelia inflata, and I haven't seen other people use the other species like cyclatica or cardinalis. I'm ready.
Great. I love lobelia, too. If you were backpacking with a group, what four or five tinctures would you take?
Are they really obnoxious and I need to take Nervines or not?
Let's see if she answered that.
Okay, I'll let it go. So, the two things I always bring would be activated charcoal, like I said, and propolis for wounds. And then I would just ask everybody, so where are we going? Now, if we're going backpacking and there's lots of oak and willow, then I just don't have to bring an astringent or an anti-inflammatory, right? Because I would want an astringent. It seems like a simple question, but it's rarely a simple question for me. I'm going to change the question. A few things that I tend to always carry on me are propolis, activated charcoal, lobelia tincture, anemone tincture, a skeletal muscle relaxant blend, and a pain formula. Those are the things I carry. And then depending where I'm going and what I have available, knowing the landscape, will alter what I'm bringing. Also, I mean, if there's just going to be a lot of dehydration because it's hot, I bring a bunch of licorice roots that people can chew to keep some moisture in their mouth. So it's not a perfect answer to what you're asking, but really for me, like being a wildcrafting botanist bragger, I would try to figure out what grows there, and then I would find out who's there. If somebody, who's in the trip, if somebody has a lot of allergies, I would definitely carry something for allergies like ragweed or eyebright. I think that's the answer, Stephen.
That's good.
That's good.
Someone asked about ticks and tick extraction.
I never extract ticks. I think putting them in alcohol is just cruel. But if I made a tick extraction, I'd probably make it 4-1. I'm joking. I know what you're asking. Lyme disease is so tricky and has no place to even start here. If somebody, I don't know any herb that if they get bit and they get a bullseye rash, will definitely help them. So I want, if you're just asking, like, if somebody has the head of a tick in them and you pull it out and you somehow know it doesn't have Lyme, then it's activated charcoal and propolis are the two ways to go if there's an infection. If there's a potential for Lyme, which is usually the question, it's so much more complex that it would just take from here till tomorrow. And unfortunately, I'm going to avoid discussing it. Next, Stephen.
Yeah. By the way, the reason why I echo everyone is because Sevensong doesn't have a headset. So when I talk, we're getting feedback through his microphone. So occasionally I mute him so that we don't get the feedback. But I don't want to do that every time I have to ask him a question. Someone asked, is it okay to keep your herbal first aid kit in the car during hot weather, or is that going to ruin your herbs?
I'm muted.
Okay.
Every time you stop, by the way, there's a woman's voice that says unmuted. By
I know, and that's why I'm avoiding muting you.
Everybody can hear that, huh? Unmuted. I'm a mutant. Unmutate. Heat definitely destroys the rubber tops on those things. It also melts the salves and probably in the long run will degrade plastic. So my first aid bag, frankly, is often in a lot of heat because I do a lot of work in summer. And so I just, every once in a while, I just change everything. So I think I wouldn't keep tinctures. If you're going to keep them if I'm going to keep any medicine in a car, I'm going to keep it in glass, and I'm going to keep one of those polystyrene or whatever, you know, those higher quality cone caps. So you have high quality plastic in glass only, and then I keep the rubber droppers separate. So basically, you have, you know, that's the way to do it. Salves are just going to melt. So I do keep something in my car, and then every once in a while I just throw it out, frankly, or I give it to a student and tell them how badly the shape of it is in. I do think that heat and car heat, which gets excessively hot where depending where you live, is problematic for the medicines and particularly the rubber on there. I also just want to say that for anybody listening to this self-aggrandizing moment, if you've enjoyed this or if you enjoyed it, forget the questions. Let me know on the Facebook page. It's fun, you know, it's really odd teaching a group of people and getting no feedback whatsoever except for making Stephen laugh every once in a while. So I would love to hear from you if you want to go to my Facebook page after this and say some stuff. All right, ready for the next question.
You do have a lot of favorable comments here.
Give me questions.
Okay. Some people asking about activating charcoal. You talked about putting it around wound.
Let me be more explicit. When somebody has a deep wound, and staph infections get deep because, you know, the bacteria just eat the skin. There must be a better word than eat, but it's close enough. And so activated charcoal is definitely something I do. When people have staph infections, I go in between activated charcoal poultices and then tinctures that are disinfecting. So I don't put them together because the activated charcoal will just absorb the herb. So when I do the activated charcoal, I take a piece of gauze, and I put about 2 to 3 millimeters, so small amount, of an activated charcoal mud slurry on it. And then I put another gauze pad on top of that, and I make it a little bit moist if I need to, and I put that directly on it. And then I tape that on. I just want to say this is important. If somebody has a staph infection that's spreading, don't use tape. Use vet wrap. So I have pictures of vet wrap. You can look it up. It's like veterinarian wrap. There's other names for vet wrap. But that stuff is really useful for putting these things on. Because when you use tape for a staph inspection, I've just seen this too many times, and you pull the tape off, you pull hair out. And where the hair was in the skin, and if the bacteria is strong enough, you'll start to get localized infections. So the vet wrap sticks to itself, not to your skin. So I want to say vet wrap is something I always carry in my first aid kit because it's so much better. And I also carry tape because, you know, you can't vet wrap a boil on a butt, for instance, right? Because you'd have to go all the way, take it off, and bowel movement, et cetera. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that I then vet wrap the activated charcoal between two gauze directly on it. But many other things, I'll just put, like if somebody has staph, a tick bite, and they pull the head out, and I want to do something to prevent infection, I would just take activated charcoal, make a slurry, meaning a muddish thing, and put it directly on there. But not for a deep wound.
Someone asked about black widow and brown recluse spider bites.
So believe it or not, I've seen black widows, but I haven't treated black widow bites. So this goes into a very long discussion that I'll avoid for the moment. There are two separations of venom in snakes and spiders both. Some of the snakes and spiders have a neurotoxin. Black widow spiders and coral snakes, when they bite you, locally is not the problem. It's systemic that's the problem. They put a neurotoxin in. So I don't treat black widow spider bites. I haven't dealt with them, so I don't actually know how to treat them. But I just want to point that it's a neurotoxin. The other hand, your copperheads and rattlesnakes, right, they're what are called crotalids, plus your brown recluses and hobo spiders, they are cytotoxic. Their venom destroys local tissue. It can get worse and go deeper, but basically what happens initially is all local. So I'm not going to cover snake bites. Can be very, you have to know what you're doing with snake bites, right? You also have to know, by the way, that a course of anti-venom for a snake bite easily runs $70,000. $70,000 easily, right? You can look it up. The numbers are clear. But, of course, it's, you know, I mean, living as much is worth $70,000. I just want to say that it's not like it's cheap and easy and anti-venom is everywhere. So, but I'm also saying, though, save the person's life. So with the spider bites, they rarely become that problematic. So if the person has a hobo bite or a brown recluse, that I tend to treat it locally with activated charcoal poultices and pound the echinacea down, easily an ounce a day. You just got to get the immunity up, give them anti-inflammatories internally too. And OSHA seems to have a special place as an anti-venomous agent. I don't know what OSHA does, but if somebody has a brown, the first thing is, right, most of the time people say they have spider bites after staph infections. There's no spider bite. It's just much cooler to have a spider bite than a staph infection. Also, you're not contagious with a spider bite, but you are with a staph infection. So you have to separate spider bites from staph infections. Once you do that, if it's a spider bite, I mean, you can use activated charcoal on both, but one of them is contagious. So if the person has a spider bite, initially, you know, what else is going on? Is it problematic? Is it affecting them in some bad way that you need medical care, different medical care? But then mostly it's localized activated charcoal, sometimes disinfecting if it's getting infected, and definitely echinacea out the wazoo. The wazoo is the other place that you put stuff, the stuff comes out. That's it for that one. Any more questions?
Someone asked, how do you recommend using propolis for a wound? My propolis is in a granular form. Wouldn't that hurt the patient?
Unmuted.
I use propolis, so I tincture propolis, but I'm gonna keep recommending all my friends here. I buy propolis from some fantastic people, Matthias and Andrea Risen at Healing Spirits. They actually buy it from somebody else, but it's hard to get bulk propolis, so I buy it in bulk. It's like $50 a pound, and then I just tincture it up. And not all of the propolis stays in solution, but a lot of the propolis is in the solution, meaning that it's liquid form. And I just apply it directly and topically. Basically, I put it on my finger, on a glove, and I just apply it directly on top of the wound. If it's really deep, I wouldn't put it in there because it's not really what I need there. Also, the alcohol will burn like mad, as you'll find out. That's how I use propolis, directly. Next question.
someone said that the activated charcoal website that you recommended didn't come up. So maybe you could post on Facebook or your website where to get the charcoal. Check it out.
Unmuted.
Okay, I haven't bought it in about a year. I actually buy it, I buy a couple of pounds a year. So it was activatedcharcoal.com. If they don't have it, I'll look for it. If it's not there, I'll just write a Facebook post. I'm not really sure the best way to get the most information out.
Can you give people your Facebook page and your website address again? Because there are many more questions we're going to be able to get to tonight, so people, again, know how to contact you.
Unmuted.
I like this. Muted. Unmuted. My Facebook page is, so my name just is Seven Song with the number seven, but it's spelled out on Facebook because they don't allow numbers. So it's SevenSong twice, Seven Song. My website is sevensong.com, number seven, numeral seven, SONG.com. Let me be really clear. I'm not going to be able to answer all of these questions on a Facebook page, and I don't want to. I want, if there's something that's simple and I can do easily, I will. But a whole onslaught of information, I am just going to turn off my computer, which is a warning, muted. So So once again, I run a school in Ithaca, New York, lovely place, and it's the Northeast School of Botanical Medicine. If you like me as a teacher, I do a weekend program, and I do a three-day-a-week program. And I just want to, one of the things I'm most proud of probably is that I work in a free clinic as an herbalist. So I'm an unlicensed, uncertified herbalist. And so just saying that, I don't have any special certification. And I've been working in the Ithaca Free Clinic now. We're on the 26th, we'll have been open 7 years. So if you want to see how herbalists can be politically active, meaning helping give free medicine and figuring out how to do that, you can. There's not a lot of information there, but you can go to the Ithaca Free Clinic. It's actually IthacaHealth.org. But I want to say it again that, you know, as herbalists, a lot of our stuff is pricey. First aid, by the way, is always free, right? So you have to be prepared for this because you could ask somebody for their MasterCard as they are going into anaphylactic shock, or you could probably just take your wallet, which is, I'm not recommending, right? So, but I mean, you're going to be giving stuff for free. So you need, I just want to be really clear and honest how I do it. I run an herb school that funds all of my clinical practice. I work in a free clinic. I go to Nicaragua and help down there with the Natural Doctors International. And I do a lot of work that's free. And so, you know, one way to do this, the way that I've done it, I'm just trying to help folks figure it out, is running an herb school because I feel okay charging for education, but I like to treat people for free. So that's the way that I've supported myself. This year, by the way, is my 20th year running the school. The most noticeable thing is that I'm not my student's age, I'm my student's parent's age. So that has seemed to have creeped up. Anything else, Stephen?
I don't think we have time for too many more questions, but one came up that I thought was good is, do you ever use comfrey in first aid?
Unmuted.
So the question's about comfrey, as you heard. I do use comfrey in first aid, mostly topically. Like so many herbalists, I've read so much about comfrey, the polarized and the middle section, but sometimes comfrey is one of the best things at growing new tissue. It's different than tannins. Tannins draw tissue together, forming a bond. Comfrey seems to increase, forgetting the keratinocytes, whatever the cells are locally, that help grow another epithelial layer. So here's, I want to say though, don't use comfrey on a deep wound because I have seen this as other herbalists have. If somebody has like a puncture wound, like a dog bite, and you put comfrey on it, what will happen is you'll get a superficial growth of epithelial skin, just your skin growing, but you'll still have bacteria underneath, and it will thrive in that anaerobic environment. So use comfrey only after you've killed infections. And we do use it topically as well. There's some other times, but it's so controversial. But I can't say the root is what I use the most because it's just stronger than the leaf. And we use it a lot in foot baths when people's feet are all just beat up and not infected. Anything else, Mr. Horn?
Well, everyone, I think we're to the end of our time here, and while there's a lot of questions that have been asked that we haven't had time to answer, which is what typically happens on these webinars, want everybody to know that this webinar, again, will be posted on the AHG website, so if you missed something, you can go back and review it and listen to it again. And, of course, encourage you to join the American Herbalist Guild. The membership is very reasonable. A general member is only $70, and we're going to be doing webinars every month for the members this year. So you'll get 12 webinars plus a fantastic journal. So be sure to go to the AHG website if you're not a member and join. And Sevensong, you are a hilarious teacher. If I hadn't been muted, there would have been tons of echoes every time I was laughing while you were telling some of your stories and jokes. And I hope everybody you appreciate Sevensong for doing this presentation tonight. I thought it was fascinating. I certainly learned a lot. So thank you very much.
Unmuted.
And thank you, Stephen, for putting it on. And so let me know, folks, Facebook. Don't call me up. It's getting late. It's in the Northeast. But thank you all for however. I have to say one more thing. Freaking do it, right? Here's the question. When people often ask me, so if you're still on here now, people often ask me, like, really? Herbal medicine for first aid? But they go, really? Herbal medicine for first aid? It's crazy. Of course plants have been used for first aid. What has been used? What set of problems have followed humans since we were salamanders? That's where I'm from, salamander lineage, right? So from the earliest days on, infections and health, we've always used herbs as first aid remedies. So it's funny when people are like, really first aid? For me, it's the most obvious place, and there are so many plants and everywhere that people have had to turn to for sprains and strains and infections, which have been with us and will be with us forever. Right, or at least till now. Maybe we all have some bionic limbs next year. So, but that's it. So do it. Do it, do it, do it, do it. Do it. Make some of these things. Make that first aid kit. Look at those early stuff. Get the flashlight. Get the disposable gloves. Get a few of the tinctures you know you'll use. And it's done. Here's one more thing. You can't practice first aid without a first aid kit, in a sense, right? You can gather stuff. The way that I became better at doing first aid is by carrying the freaking first aid bag. And so somebody has an infection and like, does anybody have anything? I'm like, I have something. So it didn't always work, but that's definitely right. So start carrying, or just have one in your home, have one in your car, watch out for the rubber, etc. But that's it for me. So thank you, everybody, and let me know what you thought, and I think that's it. Cheerio from the Northeast.
Yep. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
You still there, Stephen?
Yes, I'm still here.
Yes, I'm still here.
Is everybody still here?
Yeah, everybody.